we're sitting down with author Tom Nelson. If you like what you hear, be sure to like our page on Facebook and all the social media stuff. Download the episode, share the episode on civicmedia.us, wherever you get your podcasts, all that stuff. How's the book doing?
It's doing really well.
Surreal.
We are the top seller in the Michigan State catalog.
That way.
So that's my published in the Michigan State University Press. They've been around since 1947. So there's a lot of competition there. Totally humbled by that. And part of the reason why is it is the 50th anniversary, but it's because I think that I have something new to contribute to this 50-year-old story. And very excited about this, and it really has exceeded expectations.
So you just write this, and then you just try to find a publisher? Yeah. Like, hey, I got this thing.
Right. So really? When you write a book and you pitch it to university presses, you don't need an agent. So you can just find these emails and fill the form and send it in, and sometimes they get back to you, sometimes they don't. So Michigan State University Press saw this, one of their editors, and said, we got to get this. This is amazing. So we signed the contract right away, and we started the process to get this ball rolling. That was back, I think, December of 2023. It came out last August. So as I mentioned before, or maybe it was offline talking about how it takes so long to write these. So that was a lead up to it.
Wow. And did you have the book written when you signed the contract?
Yes.
That's crazy.
Yes. So I should mention my one of my contributors with author was Lawrence University history professor Gerald Padere. He was absolutely indispensable. He did editing. He kind of consulted on this. He's published a lot, so he knows the ropes. He was absolutely indispensable. He was also the one who encouraged me to take this up in the first place.
Oh, cool.
Although I had thought about this, talked about this for a while, there was, I think, two or three other ideas I had that I pitched him on, and he said, this is a book you want to write. This is history. Nice. This is history. This is a fresh topic. This is a fresh approach to it. Do it. So that's how that'll begin.
You talk about the tanking of the economy as well.
Mm-hmm.
How did that?
Well, that was using Fitzgerald as a vehicle literally and figuratively that carried the U.S. economy because of its role in moving taconite ore from Minnesota and to this case to Toledo, Ohio. And there were more ships as well. So what happened, it was turned into steel used to make more ships, cars in Detroit, machine tools in Milwaukee, paper machines in Green Bay and Appleton, all over. And so the Fitzgerald was more than just this tragedy. It was something that was absolutely indispensable for the U.S. economy because of their work. Think of all the hundreds of thousands, if not millions of jobs that depended on the 29 crew members of the Fitzgerald.
That's crazy.
So that's how it affects all of us. And it's not just a cool folk song, and it's not just this romantic kind of story of these guys out there and this tragedy they go through. This represented one of the most important components of the U.S. economy in the 1960s and 70s.
So, it's funny, I made a post, because of the things that I've read, whatever happened to the Fitzgerald, it nosedived and smashed into mm-hmm. and because it was so long, it was very likely that the end of the ship was still out of the water mm-hmm. when the nose mm-hmm. hit the bottom of the lake, which is like, it's just mind blowing to think about how big that ship was. What happened to it? And people were like, no, that's not what happened. It broke. Everyone's an expert.
So one of the reasons why there was a ship that sank in Lake Michigan in the 1950s, and that ship broke apart on the surface. And we know that because there were actually survivors. And they looked at how the Fitzgerald broke and what was happening, where it's sloshing back and forth. And in that, you've got, you have three compartments of taconite ore. So each one has about 8,000 or 9,000 tons, but the divider between these three holds is very permeable. So if you're out there and you're battling 10-foot, 20-foot waves in this kind of storm, you're going back and forth, it's very likely that it's breaking these holds and maybe going to the front. Mm. And so it's weighted toward the front and then nosediving. So that's one theory. And if you look at the side, if you look at a scale model of the Fitzgerald or an ore ship and you look at it, it's like a barbell where you have this thin in the middle and then you have these big weights at the end. And you're looking at this and like, of course, this thing snapped in half.
Right.
Look at where the tension is. And if it's something that's not been maintained, it's in horrible shape, it's only a matter of time for it to sink. And that's the reason why the Fitzgerald sank. The Anderson, the Sykes, and the Ford did not.
It's crazy. One of the documentaries that I think they interviewed the captain of the Anderson, and he made a comment of at the time where it was likely that the Fitz sank, they thought that they saw the lighthouse in the distance, but he made a comment of like that could have been the bow of the Fitzgerald mm-hmm. up in the air, and we just didn't know
that's
what it was. Well, how, I can't even imagine that sticking with you.
I know. This is chapter one. I begin the book with a blow-by-blow account, minute-by-minute account on November 9th and November 10th to kind of set the story. In the last page, I talk about how Bernie Cooper and his first mate, they could see the Fitzgerald's light. So they're about 10 miles away.
Right.
And on the other side was another ship that was coming in from the ocean called the Avifers. And I interviewed the son of that captain.
No way.
Oh, yeah. And that was very insightful, too. And that's in the book as well. So what happened is they were looking ahead. They saw the lights. And then they didn't see the lights, but they could see some lights beyond that, which was the Avifers. And that's when they knew it had disappeared and probably sank.
Wow. What do you think happened? Do you think it ran aground?
I don't know. It could be any of those. I think they're plausible, but they're proximate causes. Yeah. They're things that kind of tip the scales. The reason why the Fitzgerald sank, the underlying cause was it was not seaworthy.
Right.
And it was only a matter of time for that thing to sink. And of course, there hasn't been another ship that has sank in the last 50 years. So that tells you that this was a very exceptional case. It was a very exceptional ship. It was a very exceptional ship because of the business model, owner-operator. It was not maintained. There's a federal deposition that showed, in fact, that it was not. All these reasons conspire together to say, yes, the Fitzgerald was the exception. That's why the Fitzgerald is the only ship that has sank in the last 50 years.
There was a commentator that I was watching, you know, in preparation to talk to you, and he made the comment about, and he's like a ship, I don't know, historian guy, and he said that night with the where the captain of that ship is, it's right in front, and so they're going into these waves, you know, if they're big, that ship is likely taking water mm-hmm. right to the front and just seeing, you know, and they're waiting to pop out, and so they go into the sea and then waiting to pop out. And he said, if one of the theories was true, they would go down and they could have likely hit the bottom of the lake.
The ship's 700
before they
feet.
Even knew what was going on.
Absolutely. So the ship is about 700 feet long and the depth was 535 feet.
Yeah.
So think about that. It was very possible. And there were waves that were reaching 30 or 40 feet. It is entirely possible. Also, by that time in 1975, the clearance, so to speak, there's another term for it, between the top of the ship in the middle, the clearance between that and the lake was about 10 feet.
That's nothing.
That's 10 feet.
That's nothing.
I know. If the Chicago Bulls fans are correct, right. and Michael Jordan walks on water, he could have dunked on the Fitzgerald back right. in 1975.
Right.
It's not going to take that much. You know, you're overfilling this. It's just, it's been beat to the ground or to the lake. And it's no surprise you add up those factors, those facts. I mean, I've been getting this firsthand accounts. I mean, the material, the primary source material, it paints a very, very clear picture in my mind.
You have been someone in your political life who has always fought for the workers, fought for the little guy, understood what it means to be someone who could be taken advantage of. As you're writing this book, was there a point where like the blood started to boil and you're like, I got to take a second?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
You know?
Absolutely. I'm like, I can't believe it. Why hasn't anyone, you know, told this story? Why am I either the first or the second peer-reviewed published academic book ever on the Fitzgerald? We talk a lot about it. There's a lot of self-published. There's people who, of course, you know, Gordon Lightfoot fans though, but there really hasn't taken, I mean, there really hasn't been a really, really serious look at this question from a perspective different than people who are interested in shipwrecks and shipwreck enthusiasts. I spoke to the Bay Area divers in Northwestern Ohio. I did their keynote address over the weekend. And so that's a group that they like dive shipwrecks. Yeah. And so I wasn't coming from their background, but they were very, very well, you know, they were very familiar from that perspective on the Fitzgerald. And what I showed them and what I explained this to, I mean, you could drop, I mean, you could hear a needle drop. They were just kind of looking at it because this is completely new. It wasn't their background. Yes, you can examine the Fitzgerald, try and find out why it sank, what the significance is it, by looking at a different perspective, looking at it from a business model, politics, public policy, political economy, and it paints, I think, a very clear picture.
It's interesting. We'll see, you know, the documentaries and all that, they really paint a rosy picture of, oh yes, you know, the Fitzgerald would have, it set these other different records, and then all of a sudden, you know, it set a record for tonnage that was passed, and then they had to change how it's, you know, and it's like, oh, this is great. That killed people.
Yeah.
That killed people.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think another reason why people can, are attracted to the story because they can relate to it.
Sure.
Everyone knows someone who has worked in a factory, worked at a paper mill, worked at an auto plant, a machine shop, who got a pink slip. And got a pink slip because the boss, the company, was not making the right investments. They were cheap. They were allowing the industry and the business to fall to foreign competition. They were dialing back on worker protections. All of those things. The same thing happened with the Fitzgerald. The only difference is those workers paid the ultimate price.
And their families got 30 grand.
And their families got $35,000.
My God.
And it's just, I mean, it was just insulting. But see, a lot of these families, they didn't have another income stream.
Right.
And they came from small towns like Iron River in the case of Michael Armagost. And in those cases, they had some of the biggest paychecks in town. Now, it was, you know, it was commensurate with the kind of risk that they took. And they were away from families for 8 months or 9 months. And they were such sizable paychecks that when one of the crew members married and the parents and the brothers and sisters no longer had the income stream because it was going to his new family, there was a lot of tension between the in-laws.
Really?
I mean, these were very important paychecks. These are families that went through this horrendous loss, not knowing why their loved one sank, who was responsible, but they were strapped for money. They needed to get some sort of income. This company says, here's $35,000. We'll take it. Yeah. I mean, think about that.
How do people get your book?
You can go to Amazon. You can go to the Michigan State University Press. You can go down here to Lion's Mouth. I will be giving my talk at Lion's Mouth this Saturday at 3:30 p.m. Gerald Poder will also be there too. So come on down to Lion's Mouth and learn more and pick up a copy.
That is awesome. Tom, thank you so very much.
Great.
Fascinating stuff. Thank you very, very much. We'll talk some politics a little later, all right?
All right.
Stick around for my thoughts on the Rational Revolution. Thank you very much.
Just like yesterday.